It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and today we continue our series of interviews with candidates in the primary for U.S. Senator. This is our 10th such conversation. Early voting is now underway across Illinois. Primary day is March 17th. My guest today is Sean Brown. He was born and raised in the south side of Chicago. His studies took him to Iowa, where he earned a bachelor's degree in sociology and philosophy from the University of Dubuque. After that, he started a career as a paralegal in Chicago. In 2009, he went back to law school, earning a law degree from Mississippi College School of Law. For more than 5 years, he was an assistant state's attorney in Cook County. He went into private practice in 2018. And now he's one of the 10 candidates running in that Democratic primary. Sean Brown joins me today from our studios in Urbana. Welcome to the 21st Show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And as always, you can chime in with your questions today at 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. Let's just start with your background. Tell me a little bit about when and what it was like growing up in Chicago.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Auburn Auburn-Gresham area. In Chicago, and it was, you know, I had a, it was a rough area. It was a rough patch. You know, it wasn't the best schooling. It wasn't the safest environment. But, you know, my mom, she did what she had to do, and, you know, she was able to send me to private school. I went to St. Sabina, headed by Father Michael Flager.
Big name in Chicago, yeah.
Yep. I still attend church there. So, you know, but everything worked out. Went to high school at Bogan High School, which is maybe a few miles away from St. Sabina, and then went to college in the University of Dubuque.
What was it like going to Iowa, coming from the south side of Chicago?
You know, it wasn't that big of a change. So how I ended up there, I began wrestling in high school. So wrestling, we pretty much travel all over the state of Illinois, so I kind of got a taste of, you know, what Iowa was like once I went to, like, the rural areas in Illinois. So it wasn't too big of a scenery change. But, you know, in Iowa, they treat wrestlers like all-stars. So,
yeah, sure.
So, yeah, it was a great time.
So you're an attorney. What motivated you to become an attorney?
You know, it wasn't my first pick. I originally wanted to go into a computer graphics, but some of the professors that I had, one was a judge, another one was an attorney, and they kind of, like, pushed me in that direction, like, you know, why don't you do law school? And I was just like, you know, I don't know, maybe. And I did an internship as a probation officer, and part of that internship, I would meet with the judges, the state's attorneys, and the public defenders in the morning and give reports about people that got arrested the night before. And I was like, you know, I can do this. This is kind of cool.
Yeah. And so you work for the state's attorney's office as an attorney. What sort of cases did you handle there?
So my time at the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, it pretty much ran the gamut. I started off doing appellate work, so I was writing appellate briefs. I did child support enforcement. I also worked in prosecuting misdemeanors and DUI cases. I did grand jury work. Where we would indict, you know, serious cases, first-degree murders, sexual assault offenses. And then I went to juvenile delinquency where, again, you know, you're pretty much prosecuting every type of case from, you know, from small, you know, school fights up to first-degree murders.
Hmm.
After that, there's a unit that they have called the Felony Review Unit. So whenever you get charged with a felony, the state's attorney's office has to approve the felony charge. So you're basically working in tandem with the police department where they would arrest an individual, gather up their information, and then call you up. And then I would go down to the police station, review the investigation and all the evidence that they had, and then determine whether or not the person arrested should be charged with a felony and what charge they should get.
You mentioned, you know, it wasn't the easiest time growing up in Auburn Gresham. I wonder how that background influenced your outlook as, you know, doing felony reviews, doing other work in the state's attorney's office?
So individuals that don't come from that background, you know, they don't have as much perspective. So my background, my childhood, growing up, kind of seeing that in real life, it gives me more perspective that I brought to the job. So you know, there were questions I would ask. I'd be like, you know, talking to an officer, like, well, did you check this person? Did you check their Facebook? Did you do that? So, you know, it brought more, I guess, investigative skills to the situation than, you know, normal people that's not from that background wouldn't know about.
I wonder if it did it affect your empathy level, make you more or maybe even less empathetic for some of the, you know, kids, juveniles in particular, having, you know, encountering probably their worst day, right? That they're in, yeah, in court and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about being a state's attorney, though, is you kind of have to set your emotions aside and focus on the facts, because there's always going to be two sides, you know. There's the victim and then there's the defendant. So it's an unfortunate situation for both individuals, because obviously, you know, the defendant is mad that their freedom is being taken away, and then you've got a victim who, you know, who's just endured, you know, an extremely traumatic experience. So it's a situation where, you know, you understand the emotions involved, but you have to be focused and look at the facts, look at the evidence, and, you know, and do your job, essentially.
Yeah. All right. So you are running for United States Senate. This is your first time running for office.
Correct.
Why do you want to be a senator?
Well, I was looking at the condition of our country. What really kind of pushed my arm, or pulled my arm, I should say, was that everything was just so polarized. You know, everybody's getting angry about the way other people think. And then at the end of the day, you know, everyday working Illinoisans, everyday working Americans, it's like we're getting the short end of the stick while, you know, our political leaders are bickering in Washington. Nothing's really getting done. Here in Illinois, we've got skyrocketing property taxes. We've got, you know, an education system in our urban communities that's failing our students. Nobody seems to care. So, you know, just kind of looking at the front runners, even in this race, it's like, you know, we've already got these individuals in leadership. So why are we recycling leadership and expecting a different result? So somebody else needs to step up from among us that knows the struggle, that can bring real world perspective to D.C. so that we can actually get things done.
You know, that does raise a question here, because this field is, what, 10 candidates on the Democratic primary? You do have the sort of the three, what do you call them, front runners, I guess, right? People who, two are members of Congress, one's the lieutenant governor. You know, I think a question that arises with people is, like, why go for U.S. Senate, right? This is your first run for office. Why not start with, like, a school board, or, you know, even state representative, town council, something right, like that, right? Like, you are aiming high.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I've always been of the mindset, you know, it's go hard or go home. So this is a very important situation. And obviously, you know, this seat has been occupied for the last 30 years. And we're at a moment in time where, you know, something's got to give. You know, everybody's pockets are pinched tight. You know, we've got a president that is, you know, polarizing our country. So we got to have somebody that can be pragmatic, that can bring everybody back to the table, bring the civility back to Congress so that we can actually get things done. A lot of people tend to focus on, you know, what Donald Trump is doing and his powers. And it's like you're focusing on his powers, but you got to remember, like, you know, our system has three branches. Each branch has their own set of powers. So if you are focusing on what Donald Trump is doing, then you're pretty much essentially not exercising your own powers that actually, you know, that give you the ability to check both the executive branch as well as the judicial branch.
Of course, Democrats are in the minority in the Senate right now. So I think they would say, you know, and I don't know, what would you say to them? Like, look, there's only so much we can do, right? We don't have the gavel. We don't have the power.
Exactly. The problem right now, and I think both sides understand, as far as Democrats' position, is that we are extremely ideological. But where we're failing at is we're failing to make those ideologies practical so that, you know, our Republican counterparts would be in agreement with those. So it's essentially saying, you know, we're essentially just trying to push our will, but we're not giving consideration to what the other party wants and how our will would be beneficial to them. So, you know, we're essentially not finding any common ground.
All right, let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are talking with Sean Brown, one of the people running in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate in Illinois this year. This is our 10th in this series of interviews. You can find the others at 21stshow.org. You can join us today at 800-222-9455. All right, let's talk about policy. We've had the killings of Alex Preti and Renee Good in Minneapolis. There was shootings from ICE and Customs Border Patrol agents in Chicago as well. How are you thinking about, you know, what ICE and the Border Patrol are doing in places like Chicago, like Minneapolis?
It's, you know, it's tragic. It's unfortunate. It's here's the thing. We have immigration laws just like we have, you know, state and local laws. State and locally, you know, our state troopers, our local police departments enforce those state laws. We also have federal immigration law. So ICE is responsible for enforcing federal immigration law. Now, I disagree with the way that these operations are being handled, you know, in terms of essentially they're having these militarized setups on the streets armed with, you know, machine rifles. And it's just, you know, it's causing chaos and scaring everyday members of the community, you know, citizens and non-citizens alike. If you're going to have those type of operations, they need to be targeted. They need to be in a coalition with community leaders and local law enforcement so that we don't have, you know, these militarized operations on the streets of our country. That's very un-American. That's not a society that any of us would want to live in, nor would we want our children to live in that type of society.
You know, the Trust Act is an Illinois state law. There has been some talk of attempting to preempt those laws or using the power of the, you know, federal government's money to influence states to get rid of laws like that. What do you think of how, you know, this Illinois law that sort of limits how much cooperation, you know, local law enforcement authorities can have with immigration and customs enforcement?
Well, it's not necessarily. You know, the state law, we also have, you know, just like the federal system has the executive branch, we've got our own executive branch. So, you know, the attorney general, the governor, they can actually preempt those things themselves without, you know, the Trust Act having to get passed. They can file preliminary injunctions, which was eventually done, but it wasn't done when President Trump was making the threats to bring the National Guard to Illinois. So that's something that could have been done to preempt, you know, the National Guard getting here. It could have been done to preempt
going to court earlier, basically.
Exactly.
Would you favor some sort of national law that prohibited or usurped, you know, laws like the Trust Act here in Illinois?
I mean, I would favor laws that provided there was a coalition. There had to be some type of communication between the federal agency and local law enforcement in order for ICE to be on state grounds.
What do you think about this idea of abolish ICE? Was once a fringe position. It was on the far left, but there have been polls in the past few weeks showing growing support for getting rid of ICE, or at least, you know, replacing it with some other. So we used to have a, you know, it used to be Immigration and Naturalization Service.
Right. Yep.
It was a little bit softer sounding agency name.
Right.
I don't know that it was actually that much softer, but, you know, what do you think? Should we abolish ICE?
I mean, whether you abolish ICE or replace it with something else, there still has to be some entity, some agency that has to enforce our immigration laws. So, I mean, I think, you know, abolishing it is more so semantics. What really is going to happen is we have to be able to reel in how ICE is operating. That's what it really boils down to. Nobody really has a problem with ICE. I mean, it's just the manner in which these operations are being conducted.
Well, right. Okay, so when you say nobody has a problem with ICE, I would say I think some people have a problem with the people who are being recruited into it, apparently, or the way they're operating. What do you think about this move that Democrats are doing now, saying, look, I mean, we're recording this on Thursday. There's this threat of a government shutdown. Democrats are saying no masks, no, you know, wear name tags, things like that, that most police officers
exactly.
have to do. What do you think about the way they're approaching this?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. You know, whether it's local law enforcement or federal law enforcement, they need to have name tags. They need to be able to show their face. That gives trust to the community. Otherwise, you know, it's like these supposedly law enforcement officials are operating like thugs. And, you know, that's not conducive to a community that wants to have a safe environment. That brings chaos.
There is going to be a debate among Democrats, if they are able to regain power in Washington, about do we try and go back and get some accountability for what's been happening now, or do we just focus on, you know, the price of butter, so to speak, right? Where do you think about that?
I am a forward-moving thinker. You know, what's happened in the past is happened in the past. We have to move forward. As far as ICE is concerned, we need to establish laws that ensure that ICE can't just go into our state territories without our local government officials and local law enforcement cooperating with them. If there is no cooperation, then they shouldn't be on state territory.
What about the flip side of that, though? Like, if it's a policy that a Democratic administration would want to see, and then local government says, no, we don't want that here, should they be able to refuse federal enforcement? I mean, this was the whole, you know, you can go back to the Civil Rights Act,
right?
And Eisenhower sending in the National Guard to enforce school desegregation.
Absolutely. It's a situation where you have to, it's not a partisan plan. This is a situation where individuals in the particular community are fearful of these ICE agents, as you indicated, on our streets, no name tags, wearing masks, militarized, assault rifles. It's just a scary situation. So, you know, regardless of what side of the aisle that you fall on, it comes down to a situation where we have to enforce policies that are going to be productive to ensuring a safe society.
All right, we're going to have to take a short break. We'll have more with Sean Brown here on the 21st Show when we return. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with Sean Brown, one of the Democrats running in the primary for United States Senate this year. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. All right, let's talk about the economy. What can the federal government be doing to improve the economy, especially for Americans with the least income and no wealth to speak of?
Well, we've got to target big ticket items: health care, immigration, education. Those are the big ticket items. Obviously, you know, we need universal health care. The health care costs are insane right now, as everybody knows it. You know, it's, you know, bankrupting families.
Like Bernie Sanders style single payer health care? Is that?
Absolutely. So that's part of one of the things on my platform that I'm pushing. Like a lot of, you know, my opponents, they want a Medicare for all situation. But that's not pragmatic. That's not something that's actually going to get passed. It's ideological. It's a, you know, an ideal situation. But we got to be able to do things that's actually going to get passed so that, you know, we can actually feel it. The people can actually feel what's going on and see it. So the program that I'm pushing is similar to a Medicare for all. But there's there's a private option. So essentially everybody starts off with the public option, which I call it the Universal Care Plus. It includes comprehensive hospital coverage, emergency room coverage, mental health coverage. And then if people want to opt out and take private insurance, they can. That way you maintain freedom of choice and you still have the competition in the marketplace, which is going to be beneficial for both sides. Obviously, Democrats are going to love the fact that everybody's covered. And then the Republicans are going to love the fact that it's actually saving money. Everybody still has, you know, the right to choose which one that they want. And then there's still competition in the marketplace so that businesses, whether small or large, can still thrive.
Maybe an oversimplification, but it sounds like you're talking about like just a bigger version of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, right? Expand that public option to everyone at a sort of catastrophic level, maybe, and then
exactly. So right now, I think back in 2023 or 24, the government spent $4.9 trillion on health care expenses. Well, we've got about 340 million Americans. The average cost of each person going to the hospital a year is about $14,000. So that's comes out to $4.7 trillion. So you're saving, you know, $0.2 trillion, which would be $200 billion, and everybody would be covered. So, and that's not even, you know, mentioning the fact that under a single unified taxpayer system, you have greater leverage in negotiating with pharmaceutical companies to bring drug prices down. So you can even bring those costs down lower.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Nick calling from East Moline, Illinois. Nick, thank you for calling in.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to start off by stating that Warren Buffett, he said that if the companies, businesses paid their fair share of taxes and you know, didn't use the loopholes, that, you know, there wouldn't be any federal tax for working citizens, income tax, no Social Security tax, no estate tax. I was just kind of curious if, you know, and I'd like to pose this at anybody running for office or a seat that, you know, how can we start scaling that back to where they pay more of their share and the rest of us working class, you know, can start enjoying the American dream too?
Thanks for the call,
Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I definitely understand where you're coming from, but I'm of the mindset where I am absolutely against raising taxes, whether it's on individuals, large corporations, small businesses, because essentially what happens is those large corporations, whenever they get taxed more, they always pass it down to the middleman or to those beneath them. So it hurts the middle class. It hurts the poor because essentially that increase in taxes on the corporations, similar to what happened, you know, what's going on now with the tariffs, is they're essentially passing that increased tax onto us. Now, in order to get things done, obviously you need money. So my perspective on getting money to get things done, like improving infrastructure, improving broadband, improving our education system, is not to raise taxes, but it's to find different revenue streams. One of those revenue streams obviously would be immigration reform. So we had back in 1986, there was the Immigration Naturalization Act that streamlined a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants that were here since 1982. As soon as that passed, there was an immediate boost to our economy because the nationwide workforce increased. So once you've got an increase in the workforce, you've got an increase in federal taxes. And this is being done without, you know, taxing corporations or taxing individuals. But it's a boom for our economy, and you found this different revenue stream. Another way to increase money is also savings. So implementing the Universal Care Plus Act, which is my health care plan that I've created a framework for, that's actually cheaper than the system that we have now. So now we have more money that can be gone to use to be put into, you know, disenfranchised communities or into infrastructure and education. So, you know, my goal is to not tax, but to find different revenue streams so that we can boost our economy and everybody can thrive.
How would that work? So, I mean, right now we are arresting so many people who are immigrants, whether they have legal status or not, that it's actually showing up as like hurting the employment numbers right now. So I'm just trying to understand exactly. So your idea would be you'd have more immigration into the United States?
Yeah, so if we have more individuals that are able to get a streamlined path to citizenship, just like what happened about, you know, over 40 years ago back in 86. Once that Naturalization Act passed, undocumented workers were able to get citizenship. They were getting jobs, paying their fair share of taxes, and it was an immediate economic boost, a great increase in federal revenues. History repeats itself. If we do the same thing again, we now have a greater workforce because, like you said, with undocumented workers getting arrested, it's decreasing the workforce. But if they have a streamlined path to citizenship, we got greater workforce, more individuals paying into our tax system that can, you know, we use those federal revenues to get things done.
All right, we have about 8 minutes left in the program today, 800-222-9455, if you want to get in at the last minute here. One of the things I do want to ask you about is some Senate sort of procedural stuff. Would you support Chuck Schumer continuing as the leader of the Democrats in the United States Senate if elected?
I would not.
You would not?
I would not.
Why not?
You know, Chuck Schumer, he has, you know, he's performed his service, but our country, not just the Senate, but our country, we need leadership that is forward moving. We need leadership that is looking towards the future. I mean, you know, I don't know how much, you know, travel that you may do, but if you go abroad, we're behind. We're way behind. And it doesn't make sense for us to be behind when, you know, we're one of the, if not, you know, if not the richest country in the world. So, you know, whenever I go abroad, it's just eye-opening. Everybody speaks multiple languages, men, women, and children. You got the high-speed rail in Japan. Here we are, you know, still, you know.
What's your big theory of that? Like, what is the, if you could crystallize it down, what is America doing wrong that other countries are doing right?
We're stuck in the past.
How so? Like, in what way?
We're stuck in the past. We're not open to advances in technology.
What about the filibuster? What do you think about Dick Durbin has been a big backer of keeping the filibuster. What do you think about that?
I'm not opposed to it, but I definitely think there needs to be changes. It can't be used to shut down the government. You know, there needs to be, I'm in favor of more so of a step-by-step process. So the filibuster is, you know, definitely helpful in keeping open debate, but it definitely needs to be reformed so that the debate becomes more robust, and that, you know, it's not a tool or tactic used to stalemate the country. And, you know, that hurts working individuals and it hurts the constituents that we're supposed to be representing.
It's been widely reported that there was in the 2024 election, a measurable shift of Black and Latino voters, especially young men, to Donald Trump, away from Democrats, Kamala Harris in particular. What do you think those voters were not hearing from Vice President Harris and the Democrats?
You know, Donald Trump, the way that he speaks to individuals, he speaks to the everyday person. Now, whether, you know, the content of that message is, you know, approved by those individuals, that's another story. But the way that he talks to you, he talks to you like a guy you can go to the bar and have a beer with. And I think it's the communication. There's a communication gap that occurred back in 2024, largely in part because we were scrambling to get a candidate for the presidency. And, you know, we had Joe Biden at first, and then, you know, we had that fumble during the debate. And at that point, you know, it's extremely hard to put somebody else in the spotlight, you know, even though Kamala, you know, it was Kamala Harris, but it's hard to put somebody in the spotlight at that point and then try to push them on people without them really having a good understanding of what she's all about.
All right, I think we can get one more caller in here, 800-222-9455. Paul from Urbana. Paul.
Okay. How are you funding your campaign, and how do you feel generally about corporate PACs and corporate funding? And since there's a big scandal going on or concern about APAC funding in campaigns in the Chicagoland area, maybe you could comment on that too.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, it's no secret. You know, think Governor Pritzker donated $5 million to his lieutenant governor campaign about a week ago. Me personally, I am not taking any type of PAC money. All of my money is, you know, it's coming from individual donors, and I'm self-funded. So when you look at, you know, these individuals that are taking the corporate PAC money, I mean, obviously, they're not giving their money to, you know, an individual that doesn't have their benefit at heart. So, you know, voters have to be aware that, you know, when you have these people who are receiving this corporate money, you know, there's going to be some strings that come along with that. There's going to be some, you know, some endorsements that come along with that, because people don't support or give money to individuals that don't endorse or support their ideologies or their goals.
One of your opponents, Kevin Ryan, is backing a constitutional amendment that would not define money as speech. What do you think of that? Right, the Citizens United and all the cases that flowed out of that. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I understand it. I disagree with it. I think it can be, there's another way to deal with it. Because right now, essentially, obviously in this race, you know, you've got Roger who's essentially drowning everybody out.
Been on TV for months. Yeah.
With, you know, with his campaign funding. What Congress can do is they can create laws that can have limits on how much an individual can raise and use for his campaign. I mean, obviously, he's raised so much.
The Supreme Court has quashed every attempt at limits, though, right?
Yeah, but that's one of the checks that Congress has. So even though the Supreme Court can come over and say a law is unconstitutional or interpret it a certain way, Congress can then repeal that Supreme Court decision by coming up with a law that will, you know, allow that position to move forward.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Sean Brown is one of the Democrats seeking the party nomination for United States Senate here in Illinois. You can find other interviews in our series at 21stshow.org. Mr. Brown, thank you for coming in today.
Thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
That is all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow on the show, two topics. First up, trans people have been much discussed in American politics, from sports to bathrooms to healthcare, but their representation in elected office has been minimal. We'll talk with several Midwestern trans people looking to change that, running for office themselves. Plus, we'll return to some of our past guests from Caro, Illinois. It was considered a food desert until residents banded together to open a co-op grocery store. That was back in 2023. But now the store is closed. We'll talk about what went wrong and where Caro goes from here. You can find a podcast of this program on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you listen. You can also find links to that at our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Coulson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.